Thank you. I don't know if Thomas Jefferson realized he was making a musical composition when he wrote all that, but you guys did that for him. Thank you again. In the fall of 1994, the late Carl Sagan, one of the 20th century's preeminent astronomers and cosmologists, delivered a lecture at his alma mater, Cornell University. He showed a photograph that had been taken from the Voyager 1 spacecraft 4 years earlier as it was leaving our solar system some 4 billion miles away from our planet Earth. What he had to say as he showed that photograph to those in attendance had been widely published in the 16 years that have followed, usually under the title of The Pale Blue Dot. With the mysterious ways my mind often works, I found myself thinking of Dr. Sagan's words in the days leading up to last Tuesday's election, and even as I drove to the polls to cast my vote. The image that Sagan showed was just what he said it was, a barely discernible blue dot in the middle of a photograph of a small part of the inner space of our solar system. The dot was our planet Earth. Here's where Carl Sagan went with it. You see a dot. That is home. That's us. On it, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being who ever lived, lived out their lives. The aggregate of all of our joys and sufferings, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every mother and father, every inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on that mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. Then he continued, the Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could be the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of the dot, scarcely distinguishable from the inhabitants of some other corner of the dot. How frequent their misunderstandings, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity and all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. It is up to us. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another and to preserve and cherish that pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. I returned to these words a few days later, not because I wanted to get my mind off of the results, but because I needed that perspective. Elections, depending upon when they happen and how they affect those involved in them, are elating, disappointing, joyful, painful, hopeful, despairing, you name it. Now, what may I say in the course of my life, been voting for well over 40 years now, in the course of my life as I've engaged in the political life of our nation at a variety of levels, I've known all those feelings and many more. Those of you who've heard me speak my mind on any number of topics from this pulpit, particularly those that relate to the larger social and cultural and political life of our nation, will probably guess that I wasn't exactly jumping for joy last Wednesday morning. Neither was I completely disappointed. Hardly elated. But this is really not to be a sermon about my political persuasions and preferences all that much. Because for all of my interests and involvements in the political order, among the many careers I chose not to pursue was that of a political commentator or that of electoral politics. My primary calling is that of a minister in the liberal religious tradition. That's the stance from which I speak when I enter this pulpit which you have entrusted to me. Let me pick up on some of Sagan's words again. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping darkness. There is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. It is up to us. It is our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another and preserve and cherish that pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. I'll be touching on some of what happened over the past week or so, but what I mainly want to focus on is how then do we live in a kindly and compassionate and justice-seeking way, and through what kind of lens? We all look at our world through a certain lens that's been conditioned by just any number of things. Through what kind of a lens do we view this pale blue dot of a world on the little piece of territory we're given to occupy it for the few fleeting seconds of cosmic time that we're given? It's the lens through which we look that I want to first take up. I'm going to do that by doing a dip into the history of our faith tradition. I'm going to work the Unitarian side of the family for a few minutes this morning. As the 19th century gave way to the 20th, if you had asked most Unitarians of that era what their beliefs were, they probably would have cited what were known as the 5 points of Unitarianism. These 5 points were one of the predecessor affirmations of our present 7 principles of Unitarian Universalism. I'm going to start with just the first four. The first four of those 5 points of Unitarianism a little over 100 years ago were: 1, the fatherhood of God; 2, the brotherhood of man; 3, the leadership of Jesus, and note it was leadership, not saviorship, the leadership of Jesus; and 4, salvation by character, meaning that we are saved, as it were, by the kinds of personal character that we cultivate over the course of our lives. And you know, if you do a little bit of degenderizing with that fatherhood, brotherhood business, and a little bit of theological recasting, those 4 points still do have their resonance, pieces of them that I can still relate to. And it's that 5th point, though, that I find the most intriguing. After reeling off those first 4, your turn-of-the-century Unitarian would have added the 5th point, the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. Wow. That's quite a statement. And it took some pretty severe hits over the century that followed, some of which I alluded to last Sunday. A couple of world wars, a Holocaust that accompanied the rise of Nazism, nuclear weapons dropped on civilian populations, Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union death camps, a continuum de facto kind of racial apartheid in this country for at least the first half or more of that century, and on and on. And to be sure, of course, there was also a great deal of admirable human progress made in the realms of human creativity and human inventiveness, as well as the advancement of human justice. A lot of that happened as well. One quick example: children don't work in factories anymore. We got rid of child labor. But it sure didn't happen in a straight onward and upward forever trajectory. Dearly as our Unitarian spiritual ancestors may have believed and wished it were so a little over 100 years ago. The more realistic metaphor, I believe, when it comes to looking at the course of human history, was offered by yet another 19th century Unitarian and fiery abolitionist, the Reverend Theodore Parker, Boston. It was Parker who said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Martin Luther King was very fond of quoting that phrase, and it is sometimes even attributed to him, but he got it from Parker. And I believe what the Reverends Parker and King were saying, each in their own era, is that yes, over the broad sweep of human history, we do move in a gradually more humane and just and compassionate direction, but it's not a straight line. It's more like a slow-moving arc that oscillates back and forth, progressing and regressing, even as it ever so gradually bends forward. Well, okay, so what's all this have to do with the just completed midterm congressional and other elections on a little piece of territory on a pale blue dot? Well, among other things, I think they represent Parker and King's moral arc, a point on Parker and King's moral arc. The question of whether we move backward or forward, I guess, largely depends upon one's political persuasion. But I also look to them, as I look to most elections, as an indicator of what I call our national spiritual health. And I would say the most simple way to put it, which means running the risk of oversimplification, is to say that I think our spiritual health is pretty queasy at the moment. Maybe it's not just at the moment. The more I think about that, I wonder, maybe that's always been so, to a greater or lesser degree. For when I look at our history with as clear-eyed as I can, a clear-eyed mind through as clear-eyed a lens as I can, it does raise the question of how much of a United States of America have we ever been? Yes, we have been, but how much? To what extent? We were not even 100 years into our life as a nation before we fought a really bloody, horrible civil war, after all. It seems like our truly unifying moments have been born out of times of crises or loss, or an occasional unifying triumph, a world war, a presidential assassination, a moon landing, a terrorist attack. At times such as these and other similar type ones, we set aside our divisions for a time, and then it seems that we return to them. Maybe that's not all bad. Maybe it is just endemic to the nature of the complexity and the diversity of this nation that there will always be those who will feel disaffected or disempowered or on the outside while seeing that others are in or sensing that others are in. And perhaps some collection of citizens, and it's not always going to be the same person, it's not always going to be the same collection of persons, but perhaps someone is always going to be angry or disaffected or fearful about something, however reality-based or not that anger and disaffection may be. I've known those feelings of disaffection myself over the course of my life as I worked on my ongoing relationship with my country for what's coming up on 7 decades now. Much, not all, but much of what happens in the political arena has to do with attempting to play to and channel such anger and anxiety wherever it may be coming from. And at this moment, with the number of our citizens still out of work, with the economy as uncertain as it continues to be, those very real kinds of anxieties are naturally going to be addressed, and they're going to be catered to by those seeking office. How much integrity has been shown by those doing the catering is the real question. One example, we have a president of our country who is about as much of a socialist as your average bank president, but that hasn't stopped the charge from being hurled in one way or another and in some places actually sticking to the wall. Yes, some of the anger and the anxiety and the sense of disaffection felt by many in our populace is real, and some of it has been manufactured and manipulated. Whatever the case may have been, in the various quarters of our nation and state, the outcome now is what it is. And many of those now, particularly newly elected, as they will soon learn if they do not know so already, that anger and disaffection, however much of it is real and however much of it is conjured up, may get one elected. But it is not a program or a strategy for good and meaningful and positive and caring governance. How well that lesson is learned, of course, remains to be seen. And however much national spiritual health we achieve will in the end be determined by how well we can be called to our better and our higher selves rather than to our fearful and angry selves. Well, I did say earlier that I'm not a political commentator, so before I end up making a complete liar out of myself, I guess I better be moving along. I'll move on to offer some thoughts now about what it means to be a prophetic community. I think that's the message we need to take heart, wherever, however, whatever ways we may have cast a vote last Tuesday, I think we need to be reminded of what it means to be a prophetic community. To be reminded of what my Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleague and now retired Reverend Richard Gilbert calls the prophetic imperative. Dick Gilbert gave a sermon here on that topic about 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe some of you were here for that. A little less than 2 years ago, just as our current president was about to take office, I offered a sermon on the varying life journeys of Mr. Obama and Martin Luther King, respecting the value and respecting the integrity of each of their journeys. I'm going to briefly revisit what I said about the role Dr. King chose to play on the national stage with respect to the workings of the political order. He chose to play the role of a prophet, or he would tell you he was called to play the role of a prophet. And the prophet in the Judaic tradition, within which I include the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, was one who purposefully stood outside the corridors of power in order to speak truth to power. And when he stood before the Lincoln Memorial on that August day in 1963 and directed his call and challenge to this nation to rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, Dr. King was speaking in that prophetic tradition outside but to the halls of power. So the prophetic imperative then is to be that voice. How well attuned the ears of those who hold political power will be to the prophetic voice is not always going to be the same. Such are the vagaries of our political landscape, with all of its fluidity and fluctuating ways. But the voice will still be spoken. Our 7 Unitarian Universalist principles, as they have emerged out of our faith tradition of many centuries, are the same today as they were, say, last Sunday. And our covenant with one another that we will affirm and promote them is the same today as it was last Sunday. We may not all share the same strategies. We need not all to share the same strategies. Maybe it's a good thing if we don't all share the same strategies for promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person, or for the advancement of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, or for the preservation of the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. You don't all have to agree on what's the best way to attain those. But it is that prophetic imperative that calls us to stand together in seeking the best ways to attain their greater fulfillment and to be that prophetic voice in the public square in seeking their greater fulfillment. The makeup of that public square will change. Those holding power in the public square will change. But our call and our challenge does not. How much of a fulfillment of these principles we see, important as that is to us, is still not as important as our remaining faithful to them. As I said on other occasions, our primary goal is to be faithful more than to be successful. I think of Susan B. Anthony making that statement, one of our Unitarian forebears, one of our Unitarian foremothers. She devoted practically all of her adult life to the cause of women getting the vote. She did not live, however, to ever cast a vote herself, except the one which she cast illegally at one time. But familiar as she was with those words of Reverend Theodore Parker, she felt she was still helping to move that moral arc of the universe forward with all of its fits and starts, with all of its progressions and regressions. Her prophetic faith was, in time, vindicated. How she might feel about some of the women now in the public arena who are the beneficiaries of her effort is another matter, but it's not the important. She sought to move the moral arc, and she did, and that's what matters. Started off our service by singing the preamble of the Constitution. I didn't know that could be set to music either. And when the founders of our nation stated in that preamble that they were seeking to attain a more perfect union, they were implicitly acknowledging that there will always be imperfections to be overcome. They may have sincerely desired a more perfect union, as I certainly believe they did. At the same time, they were only willing, in their day and age, to enfranchise white males who were property owners when it came to those who were actually legally permitted to participate in that process and vote. They desired a more perfect union, sincerely desired a more perfect union, yet some of them also owned slaves. But even with the social and cultural blinders that these most brilliant of individuals wore, they still managed to give us a process and a means by which we can still keep working towards that yet unrealized perfect union which they sought. And our calling to bring our values and principles and prophetic convictions to that process remains unchanged and undiminished. So I'm finally back to the pale blue dot. What strikes me the most about the late Carl Sagan's commentary is the passion and the intensity of his words. He shows a photo from a spaceship demonstrating what a speck in this vast universe we are. But he does so without taking anything away from the significance of our being here. We may be a speck in space, but as Sagan reminds us, that speck is also home. I'll leave you once again with his words. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another and to preserve and cherish that pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Let's sing together hymn number 348, Guide My Feet.